do have a point.
You should.
Gosh, what a day it's been. You been busy?
Yeah, I'm headed out of town.
You are?
I've got the red eye from hell flight.
Where are you going?
I can, the first day and a half will be
just recovering.
Sea days, so I can just sleep.
How long is the cruise?
A week.
You really have the good life.
Let's get going. I'd like to welcome everyone to the work session of our City Council meeting for May 20th of 2025. Council Member Van Langeveld will join us for the regular session, but she's tied up at the moment. Our first item is Ken will introduce Amber Simmons, the new City Code of the Officer.
Well, I'm sorry to say that Sherry Pace has gotten ill today at work, and so she went home. Yeah, otherwise, she would be doing this because Amber Simmons, who is next to me, works for Sherry. But I'm very pleased to be able to do this today. Very happy that that we have a new code enforcement officer to introduce to the City Council. So this is Amber Simmons. She started work for us about a month ago on the 21st of April. We interviewed quite a number of people, and Amber has some unique qualifications and some experience that are really great. One of the best things about Amber is that she is a Foxborough resident. So that happens on occasion, we're able to hire qualified residents to be employees, and this is a great thing for us. She moved to Utah in 2013 from Texas, and she's lived in the neighborhood for 10 years with her husband and her two children. As I said, she comes with great experience. She's been a police dispatcher, both in Texas and in Utah, I believe. And she's very detail-oriented and has a terrific way with people. We were just chatting a moment ago how she's enjoying meeting residents and talking to business owners and being out in the community doing the job. She's really concentrating on cleaning up signs that are that need some attention in the city. This is an area that we just constantly battle with, as you know. And she's doing a terrific job there. And she's actually bringing a new set of eyes, which happens when we bring folks, when we have turnover and we've done our hiring job correctly. It just is amazing to me that we bring in people who have skill and expertise that we don't have, and they elevate the organization, they elevate their respective programs, and we're already seeing that just in a short month with Amber. She's definitely doing that in our community development department. She's very organized, she loves to work hard, and as I said, she's making great improvements to our organization. Anyway, we have great confidence in her capabilities, and I'm sure she'll make a great difference in North Salt Lake. And I didn't ask you this before, but would you like to say anything? Would you like to say something to us?
Hi. Thanks. As you mentioned, my name is Amber, code enforcement. I am excited to be here, I really am. He mentioned unique qualities. Being a dispatcher, I was a dispatcher for 15 years. I was able to talk with multiple people and residents and just different demeanors and different types. And so having that ability of how to talk to people, I feel like broadens what I can do and talk. Now I'm kind of stumbling through because I can't talk to you guys. But no, I do. The little bit I've been here, I have enjoyed speaking with residents and the businesses. A couple came in today with both residents and businesses to discuss business license, which is an extension from the code enforcement. So I've been enjoying that a lot. But I look forward to working with you guys and getting to know everybody here as well.
Well, thank you, Amber, and welcome. I think you'll really enjoy it here. And the thing I liked the most was you're from Texas, you know, so don't mess with Texas or our enforcement officer. So,
yep.
Oh, welcome. Thank you.
It's great to meet you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Have a great
night. Next item is Karen. And she's going to tell us everything we want to know about our long-range water planning. Now, we've had three pretty good years in a row.
We have. We hope that they continue. So what we're talking about kind of stemmed from what are the issues with recharging the aquifer? What's the situation with Weber Basin? What are the long-term things that you as the mayor and council really kind of need to know. And I know some of you have a lot of experience. Some of you are a little newer. And so some of this may be a repeat. But if you have any questions, go ahead and let me know. So really, water sustainability has three major portions. One of them, of course, is the water demand, and then our water supply. And then in our situation, the aquifer recharge and really kind of what our status is and what we need to know about that. So for water demand, we obviously have the North Salt Lake City water demand, and then we also have the regional water demands and goals and the regional water conservation goals that we need to try and reach. And then we're going to talk about kind of the future water demands. Those are based not only on population and density, but also kind of on weather forecasts. So the North Salt Lake water demand, this is for 2024. 57% of our water, both culinary and secondary combined, were used by residential uses. 25% were commercial. Big West Oil is a separate category. They use 10% of our water this year. The golf course uses 6%, and then the city connections use 2%. I'd like to point out that there has been a fairly large change in the Big West Oil consumption. Up until about 2019, 2020, they used 25% or more of the total city in the water by themselves. They have re-drilled a well. They are providing most of their own water at this point, and so that consumption has dropped significantly. So this is the North Salt Lake water demand from 2005 to 2024. If you look at the bottom box, the lighter blue at the bottom is the Weber Basin culinary that we purchase wholesale. The green stacked on top of it is the city culinary wells. The next section, there's a little gold band that starts in about 2015. That's when we switched one of our wells to be supplementary for secondary use. That's the Frida well. Then we have the Weber Basin secondary water. That purchase began in 2010 for Foxborough. And then we added the uphill area that feeds the golf course and the areas around it. And then there's a small green section stacked on top of all of them. And we have a single retail connection from somebody else. We buy water as a retail user for Hatch Park from Weber Basin. One thing to note is in 2024, our city supply was 47% from our city wells and 53% from Weber Basin. So pretty close to half and half. So the water demand...
Sorry, Karen. Can you help me understand just really quick on, I'm just thinking back on the Big West and then looking at our city culinary and secondary wells. Can anyone just drill a well, and does that affect one of the trifecta in the aquifer recharge? Could we put in more city wells and end up getting more water and buying less from Weber Basin, or is there a regulation on pulling from the aquifer?
There is. That's a great question. So in order to drill a well, you have to have water rights. There's a more explanation about water rights further on, but in general, the water right gives us the right to use the water. So in order to do any kind of diversion, such as drilling a well, you have to have a water right. To drill a new well, we get a well driller's card from the Division of Water Rights that gives us permission to do that. There are a number of wells in this aquifer. The best way to explain it is if you think about a large sponge. They're not individual cups of water or buckets, but a great big saturated sponge. And if you stick a straw in on one end and you suck the water out, the entire sponge level kind of drops. Well, our sponge has literally dozens and dozens and dozens of wells drilled in it. Some of them are large, some of them are small, some of them are fairly old. It used to be people would drill a well for a single family home or for a business. What's happened over time is people have purchased those water rights, transferred their place of use to, for example, our wells, and we drill those out. We can't get more water out of the aquifer than is there. In this particular case, Big West Oil was purchasing water that we pumped out of the aquifer, and now they're just pumping it out themselves. They had a water right and a well that the city put into use. We called it the Flying J well. We used it for a lot of years. And we had an arrangement with them based on that location of the well and our need for building additional infrastructure. When we were able to drill new wells and equip them properly, we stopped using that well. It had some iron-reducing bacteria contamination issues. They re-drilled their own well and have been using it. So kind of. People can drill a well, but it's very well regulated, and you can't just drill a well and get water as a new user. You have to purchase somebody else's water right to then be able to use it for yourself.
And were they previously paying us for that extra 15%, and now they're still pulling from the communal aquifer, but not paying us for that water?
Correct. So the original well that we took over, there had been an agreement in place. They had water rights to pull the water. So we had an agreement where some volume of water that would transfer to them was a straight through with no cost. That agreement was modified. I'm not 100% clear on all the details, but you are correct that they are not purchasing water from us at this point. They are instead paying the power costs and the maintenance costs and whatever, but obviously that's a revenue that we've lost.
Okay, thanks so much.
Sure. So this is the projected water demand, and if you look at, on the left, we talk about the total annual production that we're going to need here in the city. So the top solid blue line is the projected annual water demand in acre feet based on population and development. The dashed line below is that total projected water needed with the implementation of water conservation as projected by the plan. This was done by Bowen and Collins in our water master plan that was done a couple of years ago. So if you take a step out, this is the regional water demand impact from population. So this is the population projections done for our service area by Weber Basin Water Conservancy District from 2025 up through about 2060. And you can see that our population will continue to grow every single year. Well, the way that affects water, they look at a bunch of different scenarios with different kinds of water usages and different kinds of water conservation, looking at a total demand in acre feet. And this is kind of what they came up with from these scenarios. So if you look at the right-hand side, it's the legend that tells us what these different water types mean and what the legend says. In essence, the scenarios, which are the three at the bottom right, you can see the triangle line goes really high, projected 50 years out. That's what happens. That scenario is with minimal or no water conservation. They then have some other alternate scenarios. I think the important thing to note here is that 2020 to 2020, there's a 2020 low and a 2020 high, and then the next two columns are the 2070 low and high. And the way that they're making up the additional water to be able to get more, a higher level of water for both the high and the low projections, is a conversion of agricultural water to municipal and industrial water. So the idea, there is no more physical water.
This and is so, what's the geography of the forecast, and what's your source?
This is the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District's forecast for their entire service area. So one thing that's important to note are the regional water conservation goals. So these were established in 2019. It includes residential, commercial, institutional, and industrial water types. The ones that aren't included would be agricultural. And institutional would be things like city water schools, things of those nature, things that are governmental. The water conservation goals are based on gallons per capita per day. So we take all of our water usage, divide it by the number of people who live in that community, and divide it by the number of days in a year, and that's how we get that number. The goal for Davis County is 200 gallons per capita per day. And you can see in the map on the right that there are different goals set for different regions. If you note here, for example, if you look at the Weber River Basin, the baseline in 2015 was 250 gallons per capita per day. The goal for 2030 is 200. The goal for 2040 is 184. And in 2065, it's 175. So the conservation requirements or goals continue to increase over time. In 2024, in North Salt Lake, our number was 243 gallons per capita per day. So we have 6 years to try and reach a 200 number. It's more complicated for North Salt Lake than for other cities because we have high water users who are using industrial and commercial water. If we were purely a bedroom community, the actions of residential users in conservation would become quickly apparent in this number. If all of our residents do all the things they ought, that total number won't come down as far as it would if we were purely a bedroom community. Does that make sense? Fortunately, the goals are regional. And in discussions with the regional water users, if the goal is met, potentially less by North Salt Lake and more by someone with less industrial commercial, we have still met the goal region-wide. It's important to note that that water conservation also needs to extend to commercial and industrial users where possible. For example, their outdoor watering or improving their processes to make them more water efficient.
And really quick, is there a penalization if we don't? And is that set by the state or by Weber Basin?
These are set by the state and their mandates. And the intent is what there are rules that have to be followed, such as we have to have a water conservation plan that we have to adopt, and then we have to show we're making progress. And there are some requirements for some things. And some of those are happening. And again, it's kind of a regional basis, but the city also has to have those same components. Our water conservation plan is a required part of our upcoming general plan, for example.
And in essence, as our population is continuing to grow and exponentially, we're expected to reduce our water consumption by 30%.
Per person.
Oh, per person taking that mm-hmm. population it's growth into account?
Correct.
Okay.
Wendy? Thank you. So these are some examples of what Weber Basin Water Conservancy District is doing for water conservation. The top table shows the Flip Your Strip program and the Landscape Lawn Exchange program, which is the newer version of that. So if you look, for example, at that lawn exchange program, you can see that for 323 projects that have been completed, they have saved approximately 12 million gallons of water. In addition, they have programs to provide or to do rebates for commercial smart controllers for irrigation systems, for residential smart controllers, and for toilets. All of the North Salt Lake residents and businesses are eligible for Weber Basin rebates, even though they're not directly Weber Basin customers, but they do live within the Weber Basin service area, and so we are eligible just like everybody else.
Quick question.
Yeah.
So, on that, we're looking at population and we're looking at water consumption, but I'm assuming that there's a continual measurement of the third part, the aquifer level. Is that a continual? Because if we took out all the park strips, yes, we're taking out the consumption, but we're also taking out the retention of that water dropping down into the ground, yes?
Kind of.
If it all went cement and rocks and yes. No watering?
Kind of. So the water that we put on sod or landscaping of any kind is the least efficient way of getting water back into the aquifer to recharge. Mm. So historically, the aquifer recharge, which we'll go into soon, is coming from rainwater and natural environmental effects.
Through the ground?
So most of our users are using culinary water for outdoor watering. Those that are using secondary, Weber Basin also uses groundwater and surface water, some of which is pumped out of the same aquifer. So if you pump 1 gallon of water and use it in overhead sprinklers to water your lawn, less than a quarter of a gallon of water hits the soil, because the rest of it goes to evapotranspiration, wind, sunlight, and is consumed by the grass as it grows. We all know how wet grass can be when you mow it. And so what you end up doing is losing 50 to 75% of the water that you've put on the ground. Drip systems are much more efficient, but again, the plant uses most of the water. And so irrigation water is really not a great source of aquifer recharge.
But historically, that has been the sole source of aquifer recharge, right?
No, historically the sole source would have been rainwater.
Oh, I see. Well, okay, gotcha.
Yes. Makes sense. In current recent history, obviously irrigation water, particularly people who may have been overwatering, may have been supplementing that. But again, it's about efficiency, and it's not a great way of trying to get water in the ground. It's a really good way to have water evaporate and go away.
Okay.
Okay.
Things.
So, the water supply, culinary versus secondary. Culinary is water that we drink or potable water. Secondary is untreated water, outdoor kinds of uses that's not safe to drink. It's really important that you all understand that the line is blurring between those two types of water. Historically, secondary water was considered inexpensive, plentiful, and the treatment to get it to culinary water was where the expense occurred. No new secondary water sources are or will be developed. All of the water that is currently being developed is being developed as culinary water. And the reason for that is that the source or the development of the water is already so expensive that a new culinary water source costs basically the same as a new secondary water source. There's no savings. And so they may as well put it through the treatment process and have it available for culinary uses. So, North Salt Lake water sources are wells and springs. We have water rights to be able to use these, but it's really important to realize how the aquifer conditions affect the sources that we have available for developing or producing our own water. Weber Basin Water Conservancy District wholesales culinary and secondary water to us, and then, of course, our retail connection at Hatch Park. But what most people don't realize is that Weber Basin is also dependent upon water rights and aquifer conditions. So Weber Basin does do surface water. They have reservoirs, and they maintain the levels in different kinds of places like Causey and different locations where that water level is how they provide that untreated or secondary water. They also have wells, and they pump water out of the ground, and then they sell that water to us. So this is, sorry, it jumped ahead. This is our annual culinary water supply and demand future projection. This was part of that Bowen Collins Water Master Plan. So you can see the Weber Basin supply there at the bottom in orange, and then stacked on top of it are our water producing wells. That top pink section is the additional water supply that they projected we would need. Now, if you look where this projection begins, it begins in 2020. 2020 was the same year that Big West Oil stopped purchasing so much water from us. So these projections are absolutely correct from the information we had at the time. When our demand dropped, we have not needed to develop or provide additional sources. Instead, what we've been able to do is just our demand has dropped. In maybe 5 years, we'll do an updated water master plan and reevaluate.
Did Big West, did their demand drop, or are they getting it somewhere else?
They
or?
Drilled a well, and they're okay. Producing their own.
But along those lines, is there any, outside of electrical costs, is there any incentive for them to be good stewards of the water? Or it's like it's free, let's just take what we need and not worry about
it? So, yes and no. And in essence, you're correct. There's no real incentive for them because they're not purchasing the water. So the volume that they're using, as long as it's within their available water rights, they have the right to control what they pump and what they don't. So there's a couple of different metrics we use for how much water we need. The last slide was our total annual water demand in acre feet. This is our peak day water demand. So the reason it's significant is on a single day of the year is our highest water usage, and we call it the peak day. Peak day is typically measured in flow. In this case, it's million gallons per day. If you see on the right-hand side of the top, you can see that projected overage demand that we need to supply, and what's covering it is this darker pink area. The way that we're able to meet our peak day demand flow, if our wells and our existing Weber Basin source are not enough, we can take more water from Weber Basin during our peak days or our peak month, and it comes with a penalty rate. Just as we charge people more if they use a lot more water in a month, they push up into that penalty tier. The same thing happens when we purchase more water on a single day or a single month from Weber Basin. The reason that the numbers are so significantly different is our total water includes indoor and outdoor. So our average monthly indoor demand, and then if you compare our peak month demand, people are watering their lawns, it's hot in August. That peak month is about 4.2 times higher than our average month demand, which is why outdoor watering is such a desirable place for us to look for water conservation savings.
Quick question on these charts. These are then all projection models. Is there a reality line, like what in actuality?
Right, so this started in 2020. And when they projected forward from that, this study was completed, and the graphs are, the top red line would be with a supply buffer, and the bottom black dashed line is kind of that peak day demand.
But so where's the reality, like in actuality from 20 to 25?
We do know those numbers. I didn't overlay them on this graph.
Some projection models, I find some of the issues is that there always tends to be either a company that drops out or a new innovation that creates savings. And so then projection models get so skewed that I always like to see where the projection lie and then where the actuality lies, because they tend to start to veer as time goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Generally.
So what I do know is that in 2024, if you look here where it talks about our total water, I don't know what an acre feet, I know it a million gallons. But that's next time we update this, we'll make sure that we project how close it came. The good news is when they model these, it's less a computer model and more of an intellectual projection. So they look at what our population is, what the population projections look like. Infill is determined by counting how many acres of land we have in what zone, and then applying, if it's residential, we know the average residential use. If it's commercial, it's based on acreage. And they do a lot of work. So it's less arbitrary than what a lot of models lead to. So when we look at the regional water supply, so our city and our needs are part of this greater water region that Weber Basin does. So they track a bunch of different water supplies. These are those irrigation or those reservoir type waters that I was telling you about before. So this was in March. The percent of district capacity, they were at 82% in March compared to 77% in February. So they track these really carefully. One thing to note is by the end of March, based on Snowtell, we were at about 109% of the snowpack, but that was 92% only a month earlier. We had a really good month of snow in between February and March. So the snow water equivalent, nearly all of our water that we get, either surface water or subsurface water in our aquifer, comes from snowmelt. So the black line, this marked 2025, was the projection through the middle of March when this was provided. Again, this was done by Weber Basin. The median is the green line, so we're above median. And you can see it crossed over right around the 1st of March. Up to that point, it had been below. 2023 is that big, massive peak with that crazy historic snow year. But you can kind of see how they track and how we know what the water is going to look like for the upcoming water season.
Just project here, though. I think end of April and May, we add it to the snowpack dramatically, I think.
I'll just wait.
Yeah, I'm making that prediction.
Okay, so here in the water, this is our soil moisture. So soil moisture is not the snow that's sitting on top, but how much of that has soaked into the ground. It's impactful in a couple of different ways. Pros and cons: we want the water to go down, we want the water to run off and fill the reservoirs. What does it look like? What does it do? In this case, you can see that for 2025, the soil moisture is below the median. Black line versus green line.
A 50-year span, a 100-year span.
For the entire history that they have records, and I think it was like 150 years now. I think it was 1875. But I'm pulling that from memory.
Because, I mean, we had the 80s. They were insanely wet. Mm-hmm. And then we dropped down in 2000 and went insanely dry.
Correct.
And then we went back in the 90s and went insanely wet. And so...
So the median is just an indicator, and that's why they track so many different years and provide different kinds of data for us. So this was March, again, the same time that they were looking. And if you, the one on the left is the predicted monthly temperature. Again, why is temperature significant? The faster the snow melts, the less soaks into the ground, the more runs off into the reservoirs. If it melts fast enough, we get a lot of loss due to evapotranspiration. And so even though we have a lot of snowpack, that water doesn't become available to us. So as you can see, Utah was higher than average predicted temperatures. That was the week we had spring and snow two or three times, I think. But on the right is the monthly precipitation prediction. And again, higher than average temperatures, lower than average predicted precipitation. So fast forward to this month. This is accurate through May 15th. The one on the left is the drought conditions for the western United States. And then the one on the right is just zooming in on Utah. And you can see that Davis County is being marked as abnormally dry. Note that the very next step is a moderate drought. So abnormally dry really means that we are in low drought conditions. Then we have abnormally dry, and in the bottom corner of the state, we have extreme drought conditions continuing. So while we think we have a bunch of snowpack and everything as well, all of the snow from the 2023 massive year just brought the Great Salt Lake back to the minimum entering into critical levels. So we really still need to watch and be cautious.
Is that what they're measuring drought by, is the Salt Lake level?
No. The drought's based on precipitation level overall.
Over that same span of time?
So these are the drought outlook calendars that are published by NOAA, which is
Is it rainfall or is it snowpack?
The drought conditions are a combination of rainfall and snowpack. So when we really talk about the North Salt Lake water supply, what we're really talking about is our growth. So on the left, on the y-axis are the population estimates by year. So there's a number of different lines on here. The very top tiny dashed line would just be the Davis County growth rate predictions. And then we have a line that shows the existing plus infill plus redevelopment. That's the upper dark line. The lower solid line is existing North Salt Lake population with just infill. And infill is just simply every empty lot develops. And then the middle dash line is based on the Wasatch Front Regional Council projections. The reason that this is important for us to note, our water demand increases as our population increases. What we're really looking for are, what do we think our population is going to be in 10 years and in 20 years and in 50 years? Because that's how we determine how much water we need to have available. Please note that not all of the residents of North Salt Lake use our drinking water system or our irrigation system. There are about 1,400 people who are served by South Davis Water that are located within the boundaries of North Salt Lake. So the peak day demand projection, if you look at the top line, you can see how over time, that is with no conservation. That's what's projected, again, in the Bowen-Collins study, without any conservation efforts. So you can see as the line kind of angles up and then goes over, that's when they predict the redevelopment will lead to conservation by reducing the outdoor water demand. For example, if I have a 2-acre lot and I have an orchard and I sell, and on that same one we put 15 townhouses, the indoor demand increases, but the outdoor demand decreases. And since the outdoor demand is so much higher, once we start doing infill, the rate slows down because we're not developing new lots that need both indoor and outdoor use. And again, the dashed line is what we expect to happen with the conservation methods in place. This is the outdoor, the secondary peak day demand. And you can see that at about 2035, it's expected to completely level off. With conservation, it will go down. The reason it levels off is once everything is developed, while we can have more people, we can't have more surface area to water. So the aquifer conditions, I think kind of the key to this is that I'm just going to do some general discussion and give you some facts and some information on what we know. So we are located in the Bountiful subarea, which is part of the East Shore Aquifer System. Basically, the entire East Shore of the Great Salt Lake is in the aquifer. We've created a water users group, which is the South Davis Users, and I'll talk about kind of why and what we're doing. Water rights are a critical component to whether or not the aquifer will continue to provide the water that we need. And then just a quick touch on the Great Salt Lake concerns. The level of the lake is impactful to our greater community and to us directly. So these are the historic trends from groundwater levels. So the South Davis Water Users Group was kind of pulled together initially by Woods Cross. JUB Engineers is their consultant, and many of these slides were prepared by them. So you can see that in the last, so starting in about 1950, 1955 till today, there are some variations in the well water reads. Some of that comes from somebody replaces the level transducer or somebody changes what they're measuring from. But you can see there's a downward trend on all of these wells. So static water level is the water level when the well is not pumping. That tells us what the aquifer level is at. So aquifer levels are continuing to drop and have been dropping since the 50s. The ground subsidence that has been occurring, that's been centered in Woods Cross and expanding here into North Salt Lake, I think you're all aware of. We've talked about what's happening at a couple of our wells, where the ground's settling and the wells are not. And so we've had to do some work. We came to City Council for some funding. What they've been using is what they call INSAR, which stands for Interferometric Synthetic Aperture Radar. So what that is, it's a technique where they overfly an area with a satellite. They shoot a radar signal down, and then they measure how long it tends to come back. They then repeat that process from a similar position. The satellite knows exactly where it's located, circumferencing the Earth. And over time, you can build very, very, very detailed measurements on the movement of a ground. So if I take survey equipment, and I go and I check a ground level, I put a stake or a hub somewhere to set my datum. And if that's zero, I can measure how high something is from it. But if the entire area of the ground is settling, there's nothing I can tie to. So they use satellites. So this is what it looks like. So these are the INSAR data that was from between 2005 and 2010. So if you look at the way this cycle works, it's actually a circle. So as the ground settles, you continue around the circle. So it goes from blue to purple to red to yellow to green to blue to purple to red. It just continues on in. To kind of help orient how this looks and what these maps look like, if you look on the right-hand side right below the legend that I've kind of clipped off in that dashed yellow line, that's 215 that's turning and going south. And if you look on the very, if you look in that middle concentric area where all the rings are tied together, so dead in the middle of the drawing and you go straight down, you can faintly see the on-off ramp work that's there at Legacy. So the center of this is really located right about 1500 south.
So, sorry, very high level. Blue means what and yellow means what?
That what they mean is that it has moved a whole cycle. So if you pick a spot that's blue, so let's say you go to that center clutch with all the little concentric rings, and it's dark blue towards the outer, not the biggest ring, but the first round one. See how it's dark blue, and then you cross, and it goes green, yellow, red, blue again?
Yeah.
From blue to blue is 6 centimeters. It's a circle. So the colors don't mean anything.
Okay.
They
okay.
help. It's a gradation. So you can see as the colors change quickly, it's settling abruptly.
I have a question, though. When I look at the Farm Meadow subdivision that are in the parallelogram, sort of, that is where we're seeing the subsidence that is significant.
Correct.
And yet, are you saying that the 1500 south, where is it?
I'm just trying to help orient. It is the Farm Meadow subdivision. I just that wasn't sure everybody would kind of recognize.
All right.
I wasn't sure that would be as recognizable as trying to help you orient with freeways. So this is the graph from 2015 to 2016. And this is where it gets interesting. In 2017 to 2023, you can see there's no longer a single central location for the subsidence. You can see that now we kind of have these multiple pockets. It's very important to note there are a number of wells, some of which are municipal, some of which are owned by other governmental agencies such as Weber Basin, some of which are owned by private entities such as refineries and others, that are located in these, but you can see how this pocket's kind of swelling. If you look at the right-hand lower side where those concentric rings are and you slide right down, that's 215. That's the south end of our city.
And what do the numbers mean? 10, 9, 6, 4 on that lower right-hand side.
You know, I don't know. I assume that they were numbering the rings as they're going across. But again, this was provided by JUB. I don't have a lot more information.
Yeah, then there wasn't a legend on this one.
Correct. So this is the summation of what the NSAR data showed us between 2005 and 2023. And that's that we had a total combined settlement of 9+ inches. So as you know, because we've kind of talked about this before, if everything in the ground settles perfectly evenly, it's not really a problem. When things settle differentially, or when we have a well anchored 300 feet in the ground, it's a really big problem. The reason that we care mostly about this is not that we're seeing in our city a lot of damage to structures or any damage to structures. The reason we care is as the ground settles, it's indicative of what's happening in our aquifer. So we have soil that's saturated because the water level is this high. And as the water level drops, we have expansive soils. And that soil is now consolidating and shrinking, and that's why the ground is settling. If we re-wet that, if the water comes back up, the ground will not recover. It doesn't go back to its previous height. But this is indicative of a long-term, fairly serious problem with our aquifer. And so,
you know what? Go ahead and do this, and then I'll ask.
Okay, so let's kind of talk about how the aquifer recharges and why and how and what we're looking for. So for aquifer recharge, we're really looking at kind of what are the sources of recharge, and then kind of the long-term planning on what do we need to do and what do we need to be aware of. So the most important piece of this is we need to talk about the aquifer users and the impacts on recharge. So we've been talking about the South Davis County groundwater users. So there's a couple of different groups that have met. The technical advisory committee are all of the engineers, city engineers, engineers who work for Weber Basin, who work for the county, et cetera. Everybody who's got a straw stuck in this aquifer. So aquifer 101. You've probably heard me go through this before. So exciting. But the water rains down on the upper mountains. That's our primary recharge area. We have an additional or secondary recharge area, which is along the bench. So if you look down, you can see the wells that are drilled down into the aquifer and where they pull the water from. So again, it's like a sponge. We go down in the earth, the water moves through the soil, we suck it out through the wells. The dashed line that runs across, you can see on the left, the Great Salt Lake, and it runs across and it hits, and that's our well level. You can see where it crosses the well, I hope. As the Great Salt Lake level drops and the aquifer level drops, those are the same potentiometric elevations. So one of the problems is as that level drops and we continue to pump water, if there's not enough water from the recharge in the mountains and the foothills, we could start pulling water back from the Great Salt Lake. We're currently monitoring for salinity levels. One of the problems that could happen if the aquifer is dropped and we dump water directly into the lake, it could actually push the salt back into the aquifer through the ground. So really what we're looking here is the water that falls in the mountains takes about 10 to 15 years, 15 years from the mountain peaks, 10 years from the foothill, to reach our well. The natural source of recharge is rainwater and snowmelt. That's where historically all groundwater came from before man was ever here. So who's using the water and how much are we using? So in this situation, the folks who use the water use it for culinary, for irrigation, and for industrial. The total water removed from the aquifer by all of the users listed, and these are not all, these are just the majority or the large users, this is 13.7 million gallons per day. It is 4.8 billion gallons of water a year. So if you notice, North Salt Lake is listed as using about 23% of the water. Please note that while this is true, we use the water for culinary, for irrigation, and for industrial. Every other user in South Davis County has access to Weber Basin water. So all providers except for Weber Basin are only providing indoor water use, which is why our water looks so much higher. Please note that while we use 23% of the water, Weber Basin uses 13% of the water for culinary production. So just buying water from them doesn't actually change where the water's coming from necessarily. So the way the aquifer recharges, how we recharge, and kind of what we need to look at long term is kind of an important question. So this is a map of the recharge areas in this basin. So the darkest brown color on the outside edge is that primary recharge area that is the bedrock that's up in the mountain peaks. We also have a primary recharge area, which is the unconsolidated basin fill. That's our foothill areas. If you look at kind of the map, the secondary recharge doesn't reach our aquifer. We have a partially confined or confined aquifer. And I probably should have added one more drawing. Sorry. But if you look at this map, can you see where the arrows are coming up and it says confined aquifer? Any water that comes down, that's a layer of clay that the water can't get through. So any water that comes down below a certain elevation never reaches the aquifer we get our drinking water from. I probably could have just explained that. In this case, the secondary recharge is not a location that necessarily is as beneficial as primary, but it is a recharge location. And then all of the area where it turns darker brown again, west of I-15, that is a discharge area. Doesn't matter what water goes in the ground there, it will never reach the aquifer. So, water rights, an additional part of this picture. So, water rights is the right to use the water. We don't actually own the water, we just own the right to use it. All water is owned by the state of Utah. Water is measured in a couple of different ways. One's diversion, that's the amount of water you remove from the system. And then we also have a depletion requirement, which is the amount of water that we're allowed to, the remainder of which has to go back. So we can deplete the water. So if we have 1 gallon of water and we use half of it, then half of it goes back, we've depleted it by half a gallon. Both of those are measured and are part of our water rights. All water rights are based on the underlying water right. So if we have a water right that we purchased from a stockyard that was, we bought in 1943, but the original water right was filed 100 years before, then the underlying right is that original water right filing. We can't enlarge it, we can't increase the use, and we can't increase the diversion. But we get the original filing date. It's important because Utah operates under what is called a first-in-time, first-in-right. So if you have a water right that is 100 years old, and I have a water right that's 10 years old, in years of shortage, when there's not enough water for everyone to get all of their water, you will get 100% of your water, and my water will be decreased by the amount because your water right is older. So it becomes really significant in the face of an environment like this where our basin is over-appropriated, more water is being removed from the aquifer every year with legal, perfected water rights. But the aquifer isn't actually capable of producing that much water every year without being depleted. So some things are going to need to change. And all of the water users in the basin are attempting to find solutions and work together so the state doesn't need to come in and do basin reappropriations. So water sustainability. Really, it's in between water consumption and that aquifer recharge. How much are we removing from the aquifer versus how much is going back in, and which and what parts of those can we actually control? So just kind of, I've been jumping around a little bit to put it all together. We have increased development of land in our city. People move in, build houses, build businesses, do developments. That increases the demand on our water supply. We're increasingly diverting water out of the natural hydrogeologic cycle. So every time it rains, where there used to be a field, there's now a house. The water runs down the roof drains, goes out to the road. The water runs down the driveway. The road didn't used to be there. And so all this water runs into the storm drain and goes away. Additionally, we're often diverting springs. So if somebody digs a house, anywhere on our hillside, they might find a spring. Well, because they don't want their basement flooded, and we don't want their basement flooded, they divert the springs out into the storm drain system. And that water now is no longer part of that natural cycle. So more water is getting pumped out, and less is getting returned. And so now we have a reduced water supply. So the population, same kind of overview. Our population's increasing and will continue to increase. Some of it's people moving in. More of it's the fact that, for example, my mother's still alive. I'm still alive. I have four children who are on the verge of getting married and having children. And hopefully they'll meet their great-grandmother. So my family is part of the population growth, because we're all still here living in northern Utah.
However, a little pushback, because I've thought a lot about this. Utah is for the first time in a negative population cycle. The country overall has been in that negative replacement for quite a while. We're losing baby boomers, which is our largest population growth, and every two adults are having less than two children. And we're mostly built out in Davis County. And
sure,
so,
but if everybody has two children or less, It only replaces the population evenly if the parent dies when the child's born. Or, right?
Over
so we're,
decades.
We're still growing.
So we're, over decades, like where this chart went up to 2070,
a lot
we're
of
probably
it's,
two decades between before we might start seeing true population decline, which we haven't seen in a good 50-plus years in our country, but
and we definitely could. And a lot of the projections that are done are based on trends that are no longer holding. I hope to get a grandchild someday.
Exactly, you and everybody.
But the idea is that we don't actually know, and so that's why we redo all of these studies, and we'll do another one in about 5 years, and we'll see kind of how things have trended and what we think will happen next. So in this particular case, it's also important to note that there are, whether it's climate changes or just climate cycles, the fact is that we're currently in a current round of less water. We have less rainwater, we have warmer temperatures, both of which affect our water supply. Part of that is when it's warmer outside, people use more water on their lawns or on their plants to keep them alive. There's a resistance to change by existing users. If you've lived in a house for 25 years or for 5 years, and you have a completed landscape and you water it, there's very little incentive for the good of the community to remove your landscaping and pay another how many thousand dollars for somebody to come in and put in something that is a little more water conservative. So there's some resistance to change for people who are already living in an area. All of this adds together where we have increased demand and we have reduced recharge. Again, the streets, the driveways, the houses, less natural water is going into the system. And under current climate conditions, less natural water is reaching us to begin with. So what can we do? Well, obviously, one of the options or things that need to be done is we need to reduce the volume of withdrawals from the aquifer. We can only withdraw as much water as the aquifer can sustain. There are multiple users, each with individual water needs. So everybody's got a straw stuck in the same sponge. So if I no longer drink from the straw, but all of you have a straw and you all drink the same amount or more, I can choose for myself what I'm doing, but it doesn't really impact the overall picture, which is why we're doing cooperative efforts and working as a group. We need to look at recharge. Back in the 70s and 80s, things like sumps, reservoirs, open storm drain channels that were dirt on the bottom were really very common. We've since piped all of them. All of the sumps have been diverted into storm drain, and so we really need to look at how we're going to increase that recharge back to groundwater in ways that used to happen that aren't anymore. Stormwater and springs. We've been diverting them into a storm drain system, and they flow out of the city and are gone. Stormwater and spring water really need to be considered as an indirect water source. That's how the groundwater has always recharged in the past. And instead of allowing additional and potentially undoing some of the connections to the storm drain by getting that water back where it belongs, that eventually becomes an actual water source that we pump out in our well. We've been working on reuse water. There have been some really large changes in state rules due to some legislation that's been passed. However, we do have existing water rights that were filed prior to the legislative changes for water that's usable from the discharged treated water from South Davis Water, South Davis Sewer District. We do have the option, and we're looking at ways to implement this use. Because it can be used for outdoor water, such as irrigation, it's perfectly safe, then that can, of course, reduce the demand of what we're pumping out of the aquifer. The diversion of water versus that on-site retention percolation. So instead of allowing water to be diverted off of a home site or somewhere else, looking at ways of using percolation to reintroduce it back to the natural geologic cycle. When we do plan review, home locations, this is something we're increasingly looking at doing, and we really need to look at how we're changing the standards that North Salt Lake's operating under. And then finally, we need to figure out how to reuse or reintroduce water in the correct location. So this is not reuse water, and it's not percolation. What we're really looking at, for example, is we have some existing infrastructure. One of the projects we did this year was diversion of stormwater into the lake at the golf course instead of its existing path. Half a dozen reasons we did this. The pipe was too small. We were blowing off manholes. There were lots of engineering reasons. It now goes into the lake. The overflow from the lake flows down and hits our secondary water basin and is a secondary water holding basin. So the natural storm water that falls on the golf course and the surrounding area that flows into the lake just refeeds the water that we put on that same ground. So we're basically just taking the water that hits the road and putting it on the grass, which is where it would have fallen historically. We also need to make sure that we're protecting from overflow and waste. So long term, we need to look at doing studies that help us identify where we can provide this recharge. Currently, in the wintertime, overflow from the lake and other locations goes down to the storm drain, discharges through the storm drain system and out of the city. An option may be rediverting the overflow into a settling pond, where that water then flows back into the ground, and then only in high overflows does it continue to go down. Studies are important. We're looking at working with people like the cities that are on the lower end who don't have the opportunity to recharge. If, for example, they had water available in December and we have land high enough up on the hill, working together are some options. Ironically, one of the really good ways to get water to infiltrate into the ground is to make snow. So our sledding hill is a water recharge function. So water sustainability, just kind of the big push at the finish here. Water demand, really, our population's going to continue to increase. Indoor versus outdoor demand, we're going to have to make some hard choices in the future to attain the water conservation that we need, particularly in outdoor water. We've made a lot of good strides. The new irrigation standards or the new landscaping standards with no sod and park strips, etc. It's really important that we recognize that this is about gallons per capita per day, not total gallons. We don't need to reduce our consumption. We need to reduce how much each person is using. Our water supply, there are no easy new sources. In this year's Weber Basin update to all of their users wholesale and all of the connections that they sell to, they made a statement, and that is there are no future sources that will be available. Weber Basin will not have any additional water to sell in the future. There is just no more water. They're looking at bringing water in from out of state. They've looked as far as the Mississippi River and Alaska. And everyone they've reached out to has said, we don't have any water either.
Have they looked at how much we sell to other states?
We don't have the option of not. It goes back into the water right function. So for example, most of the water that comes, not most, the highest priority, oldest water rights that come from the Weber Basin area were first developed and diverted to the Provo Valley. They have the oldest water rights. They get the first call. If that water volume lowers below a certain threshold, they still get 100% of their water. We get 100% of the haircut.
And then two other states, we're selling water to Colorado and to California. Okay.
Yes, and then there's things like the...
Sounds like
the
political reallocation to me.
It gets really, really complicated. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the original volumes that were estimated from many of those old were wildly optimistic. And so there was not a, will you get 52% and we get 48%. It's you get X gallons and we get what's left. Well, the volume that they anticipated was never there, but they still get all of their gallons. So in addition to selling water, there's also these very old and legally binding contracts that are not very helpful for us. It's really important to note for water supply, we really need reduced withdrawals from the aquifer. We need a sustainable level of withdrawal. And then, of course, the big one is these cooperative solutions with all the water users that we work with. For aquifer recharge, really, we need to talk about diverting stormwater in springs or stopping the diversion of stormwater in springs. In the future, we really need to do a recharge study. Part of this users group, we're talking about doing it as a joint effort basin-wide for South Davis. And again, those cooperative solutions where everybody's got their straw stuck in the same milkshake. And it can't be one. If we put a bunch of water in and everybody else just keeps drinking, it doesn't really help anybody. Do you have any questions?
Well, I kind of went down this rabbit hole a couple of years ago, and I looked at the Great Salt Lake over the last, it's just under 200 years, 150 years kind of is when they were looking at it. And so my ancestors founded Antelope Island and lived out in Antelope Island. And in a lot of their journals, they talked about walking across the majority of the Great Salt Lake because it was so low back when Utah was settled that you could walk across much of it, some of it, you know, 6 inches or less. And then, of course, we know the lake is now where it is. My friends in the 90s, they owned Saltaire, if you remember Saltaire. And it was super fun. You could boat, you could swim, kind of a Taj Mahal building. And then in the 90s, the lake flooded for several years in a row, and they actually went bankrupt because Saltaire was underwater, like the facility was underwater, and the lake got very desalinated because of just the tremendous amount of water that we got over a few years in a row. And so the lake went up by quite a bit. And then it's slowly been going down, but when I looked at the 150-year lake levels, it varied a lot, and when it went up, then it went down. And we're talking decades. And then it went up, and then it went down. And so we are in a down, but we're actually on a slightly up. And if it follows that same pattern, we could be for a big up. Like, we could be.
We could be.
If it follows that 150-year pattern.
No, I agree. And that's part of the reason why I talked about the weather cycles, because it does kind of fluctuate. The important thing to note is that since 1950, the aquifer level has been dropping. Mm-hmm. So while it follows
even
conditions
though the
with the lake.
Even risen so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I have a question on the aquifer and the recharge.
Sure.
If we don't address the aquifers soon enough, they will collapse. And isn't that what the subsidence is?
So, yes.
And
so,
that isn't something that we can then recreate. So once it's gone, it's gone.
Sure. So collapse kind of gives the vision of a cavern that's falling. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that these aquifers are not caverns, they're not cups, they're sponges. So while certain kinds of aquifers can have the kind of catastrophic failure that those words evoke, what we're really looking at here is a water level that drops so far that the wells that are equipped can't pump it properly. We're not going to have the inability to get any water out of it. The important thing is what is most likely to happen. If we do not stop over pumping the aquifer, and not we individually, but we as an entire group, what is most likely to happen is the State Division of Water Rights will come in and they'll say, okay, here's how much water and where you can pump and when. And here's how much you can have and when. We are hopeful to avoid the state making redeterminations by cooperatively figuring out better solutions. So we've been discussing with the group, for example, what water sources might we have that we can bring in from outside the basin? And do we have the option, for example, Weber Basin, which may have wells in multiple locations, could they not use this one? Could they use more from another one? So we're trying to work out some options and some considerations, for sure.
And the state's not trying to renegotiate what we're selling to other states? Like, is that just...
Unfortunately,
they'd rather pull from our own state and suck us dry than renegotiate?
So unfortunately, that doesn't have any impact on any of us because that water isn't ours. Mm-mm. We only have access to the aquifer that we have water rights for.
So I love that you and we are coordinating with Weber Basin and thinking about that scale. And then you mentioned the water conservation plan in the general plan, component of the general plan. And so I'm eager to have us talk through our policy options mm-hmm. in that conversation. And my question to you is aquifer health part of that as well? Are you coordinating with the consultant to include key information like from this presentation in that and exploring with them policy ideas?
So that has not been brought up, but it's a great recommendation. I'll coordinate with Sherry and others and see.
Can I interrupt you there, Karen?
Of course.
Because there is a South Valley Water group that's getting together and talking about those very things. So it's being led out by Woods Cross, I think.
Yeah, it's Woods Cross, ourselves, West Bountiful. And I may have misunderstood. I thought the question was about city policy for things in our general plan like landscaping and drains and things like that.
It might have been. I just wanted to make sure that you understood we're part of a group that is looking at things like the health of the aquifer and water recharge. And
absolutely.
I don't believe that any of these communities as a group are going to allow these aquifers to, fail or, we're not in charge of the weather or we're not in control of the weather, but there are people who are working on this all the time. So I just didn't want, I don't want to leave an impression that there's some big problem out there because
I don't think
long-term issues, of course, but.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, amen, right? Like, I'm not sure that it's time to panic, and I didn't get that panic message, but I did get the message of we have to be proactive and we have to pursue things at a couple of scales, the cross-city scale and the local scale. And, so let's look forward to doing that.
Including water conservation. So I think the next time we show you statistics or projections, we will have the benefit of several years of Big West Oil not consuming a portion of our culinary water the way they did before. And I recognize it's all from the same sponge, so mm-hmm. you know, that's that issue is always out there. But I don't believe we will ever have to go to Weber Basin and purchase additional water, for example. So even though they have none right now, and they may develop some in the future, I know they're working on that, I don't think our city is going to have to go seek new water sources necessarily. Now, things could change, and of course, that's why Karen's here and others who are working on it. But I think the city is in really good condition with, you know, with the background that water is a resource that's finite, and we need to be careful on the Wasatch Front, the entire Wasatch Front.
That was my question. The Wasatch Front, particularly Davis County, the question that I've got on that is, like, we're having a problem, say, for example, in North Salt Lake or Woods Cross. They'll have one in Farmington, and they're going to have one in Layton, and they're going to have a similar one. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think it's important to know that when you say we're having a problem with our aquifer, the key is that if you look at those downward trends, they're fairly mild and fairly low. Took a really long time for us to figure out those levels were, in fact, decreasing. The problem with the houses in Woods Cross kind of brought it to everybody's attention, yeah. Started doing a bunch of research. The amount of water that we pump out of the aquifer and put back in is within our control.
Yeah.
We have other sources. There are other options. We've talked about reuse water. We've talked about additional secondary water, which our withdrawals from the aquifer are significantly less now that we've put the golf course and 300 homes and all of Foxborough on secondary. However, this isn't a surprise. We've known this is coming, and there's nothing urgently wrong.
Well, however, the subsidence itself to me is a diagnosis of some illness.
Absolutely.
And I don't think we want to downplay that. Now, I just read that Woods Cross is going to have they're declaring an intent to issue water revenue bonds next month in the amount of $11 million. Are they doing that to address the problem with subsidence as part of it?
I have not heard about that.
I don't know the answer to that either.
I mean, that's a pretty dramatic bond, revenue bond that they want. So I just saw that today, but that's in the 1st of June. So I think, like you say, you've got this working group. And I guess just to end off, masterful presentation. We need to have that, like, as a presentation in D.C. on how it should be done for all the National Leagues of Cities and Towns, because that was amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Quick city question. We have a reservoir right up the street here by the school. But it's dry. Is that not a functioning reservoir?
So we don't have any open air reservoirs in the city except for the one on Eaglewood Drive. And the reason that we did is we took a previous detention basin and made it a secondary water storage. We have a number of basins in the city that are detention basins. So in really large storm events, they'll fill with water and control the outflow. The basins that you see in our city that have water in them in the summertime belong to South Davis Water.
Oh, so the one that is right there by the school, yeah. Is that South Davis Water then? Or is it just a detention basin?
So the South Davis ones I know of are up past 350 East. Palmquist, that one's South Davis Water.
Yeah. Oh, it is South Davis. Yeah. And is it a reservoir?
They do have a secondary water reservoir right there.
But it's dry.
Oh, it may be that they are using it, they're repairing it, they're diverted. I don't know their operations. Mm-hmm. It has had water in it for all the years I've been here previously.
Yeah, I was just surprised.
Yeah.
And then, this is probably a John question. So just to clarify, we've shut off the fluoride, and what did we do with the remainder? My favorite thing, you know.
Yeah. We're still trying to hear back from a company that's going to come and get the fluoride. So
it's just sitting right now?
Yeah, it's still just in the tanks, but we've disconnected it completely. So even if the pump turned on, nothing would go into the system.
And is it just a toxic waste company?
Yeah, it's like a Clean Harbors or something, I believe, is who we're trying to contact.
Weber Basin, okay.
Yeah, the same company that Weber Basin's using.
Awesome, thank you. And thank you, Karen. I know this was a lot per my request, so that was so helpful. Thank you.
I guess Karen's analogy of the straw in the sponge, I always felt good. I was driving over to Bountiful to shower every morning. But I'm not really helping.
Same sponge.
I just want to mention that on the 24th of June, Weber Basin has their watershed tour. It's really fascinating to go on. And I signed up this year. I did it like 4 years ago, and I thought I'd do it again. But
will you share that information? Like the
I don't even know. I RSVP'd like a month ago, so
I'll send it out to you. That's in my management report. I'll send you an email tonight during the meeting, and you'll be able to RSVP.
Anyway, it's an interesting tour. Takes most of the day, but it's worth it. Thank you, Karen. Heidi, we're going to put you on hold, okay? And we'll take a quick break and reconvene.